The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the July 26, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Teresa Job, by Colson Whitehead. Carney took the long way to Nightbirds. The first hot spell of the year was a rehearsal for the summer to come. Everyone a bit rusty, but it was coming back. They took their places. On the corner, two white cops recapped the fire hydrant cursing. Kids had been running in and out of the spray for days. Threadbare blankets lined fire escapes. The stoops bustled with men in undershirts drinking beer and jiving over the noise from transistor radios. The DJs piping up between songs like Friends with Bad Advice. Anything to delay the return to sweltering rooms, the busted sinks and clotted flypaper, the accumulated reminders of your place in the order. Unseen on the rooftops, the denizens of tar beaches pointed to the lights of bridges and planes. The atmosphere in Nightbirds was ever 5 minutes after a big argument with no one telling you what it had been about or who'd won. Everyone in their neutral corners, replaying KOs and low blows and devising too-late parries, glancing around and kneading grudges in their fists. In its heyday, the joint had been a warehouse of mealy human commerce, some species of hustler at that table, his boss at the next, marks minnowing between. Closing time meant secrets kept. Whenever Carney looked over his shoulder, he frowned at the grubby pageant. Rheingold beer on tap, Rheingold neon on the walls. The brewery had been trying to reach the African-American market. The cracks in the red vinyl upholstery of the old banquettes were stiff and sharp enough to cut skin. Less dodgy with the change in management, Carney had to allow. In the old days, broken men had hunched over the phone, hangdog, waiting for the ring that would change their luck. But last year, with the new owner, Bert, had had the number on the payphone changed, undermining a host of shady deals and alibis. He also put in a new overhead fan and kicked out the hookers. The pimps were okay. They were good tippers. He removed the dartboard, the last renovation, an inscrutable one, until Bert explained that his uncle had his eye put out in the army. He hung a picture of Martin Luther King, Jr. in its place, a grimy halo describing the outline of the former occupant. Some regulars had beat it for the bar up the street, but Bert and Freddie had hit it off quickly. Freddie, by nature, adept at sizing up the conditions on the field and making adjustments. When Carney walked in, his cousin and Bert were talking about the day's races and how they'd gone. "Ray, Ray," Freddie said, hugging him. "How you doing, Freddie?" Bert nodded at them and went deaf and dumb, pretending to check that there was enough rye out front. Freddie looked healthy. Carney was relieved to see. He wore an orange camp shirt with blue stripes and the black slacks from his short-lived waiter gig a few years back. He'd always been lean, and when he didn't take care of himself, quickly got a bad kind of thin. "Look at my two skinny boys," Aunt Millie used to say when they came in from playing in the street. They were mistaken for brothers by most of the world, but distinguished by many features of personality, like common sense. Carney had it. Freddy's tended to fall out of a hole in his pocket. He never carried it long. Common sense, for example, told you not to take a numbers job with Pee Wee Gibson. It also told you that if you took such a job, it was in your interest not to F it up. But Freddie had done both of these things and somehow retained his fingers. Luck stepped in for what he lacked otherwise. Freddie was vague about where he'd been lately. A little work, a little shacking up. Work for him was something crooked. Shacking up was a woman with a decent job and a trusting nature, who was not too much of a detective. He asked after business in Carney's furniture store. It'll pick up. Sipping his beer, Freddie started in on his enthusiasm for the new soul food place down the block. Carney waited for him to get around to what was really on his mind. It took Dave Baby Cortez on the jukebox with that damn organ song, loud and manic. Freddie leaned over. "You heard me talk about this N-word every once in a while. Miami Joe? What's he, run numbers? No, he's that dude wears that purple suit with the hat." Carney thought he remembered him, maybe. It wasn't like purple suits were a rarity in the neighborhood. Miami Joe wasn't into numbers. He did stick-ups, Freddie said. Knocked over a truck full of Hoovers in Queens last Christmas. They say he did that Fisher job back when. What's that? He broke into a safe at Gimbel's, Freddie said, like Carney was supposed to know. Like he subscribed to the Criminal Gazette or something. Freddie was disappointed, but continued to puff up Miami Joe. He had a big job in mind, and he'd approach Freddie about it. Carney frowned. Armed robbery was nuts. In the old days, his cousin had stayed away from stuff that heavy. It's going to be cash and a lot of jewelry that's got to get taken care of. They asked me if I knew anyone for that, and I said, I have just the guy. Who? Freddie raised his eyebrows. Carney looked over at Bert. Hang him in a museum. The barman was a pot-bellied portrait of Hear No Evil. You told them my name? Once I said I knew someone. I had to. Told them my name? You know I don't deal with that. I sell home goods. Brought that TV by last month. I didn't hear no complaints. It was gently used. No reason to complain. And those other things, not just TVs. You never asked where they came from. Well, it's none of my business. You never asked all those times, and it's been a lot of times, man. Because you know where they come from? Don't act all, gee, officer, that's news to me. Put it like that. An outside observer might get the idea that Carney trafficked quite frequently in stolen goods. But that wasn't how he saw it. There was a natural flow of goods in and out and through people's lives, from here to there, a churn of property, and Ray Carney facilitated that churn. As a middleman. Legit. Anyone who looked at his books would come to the same conclusion. The state of his books was a prideful matter with Carney, rarely shared with anyone because no one seemed very interested when he talked about his time in business school and the classes he'd excelled in, like accounting. He told this to his cousin. Middleman, like a fence. I sell furniture. It was true that his cousin did bring a necklace from time to time, or a watch, or two top-notch, or a few rings in a silver box engraved with initials. And it was true that Carney had an associate on Canal Street who helped these items on to the next leg of their journey, from time to time. Now that he had added up all those occasions, they numbered more than he'd thought, but that was not the point. Nothing like what you're talking about now. You don't know what you can do, Ray. You never have. That's why you have me. This ain't stealing candy from Mr. Nevins, Freddie. It's not candy, Freddie said. He smiled. It's the Hotel Teresa. Two guys tumbled through the front door, brawling. Bert reached for Jack Lightning, the baseball bat he kept by the register. Summer had come to Harlem. At Nightbirds, Freddie had made Carney promise to think about it, knowing that he usually came around if he thought too long about one of his cousin's plots. A night of Carney staring at the ceiling would close the deal, the cracks up there like a sketch of the cracks in his self-control. It was part of their Laurel and Hardy routine. Freddie sweet-talks Carney into an ill-advised scheme, and the mismatched duo tries to outrun the consequences. "Here's another fine mess you've gotten me into." His cousin was a hypnotist, and suddenly Carney's on lookout while Freddie shoplifts comics at the Five and Dime, or they're cutting class to catch a cowboy double feature at Lowe's. Two drinks at Nightbirds, and then Dawn squeaking through the window of Miss Mary's after-hours joint, moonshine rolling in their heads like an iron ball. "There's a necklace I got to get off my hands. Can you help me out?" Whenever Aunt Millie interrogated Freddie over some story the neighbors told her, Carney stepped up with an alibi. No one would ever suspect Carney of telling a lie, of not being on the up and up. He liked it that way. For Freddie to give his name to Miami Joe and whatever crew he'd thrown in with, it was unforgivable. Carney's furniture was in the damn phone book, in the Amsterdam News, when he could afford to place an ad, and anyone could track him down. Carney agreed to sleep on it. The next morning he remained unswayed by the ceiling. He was a legitimate businessman, for Christ's sake, with a wife and a kid and another kid on the way. He had to figure out what to do about his cousin. It didn't make sense. A hood like Miami Joe bringing small-time Freddie in on the job? And Freddie saying yes, that was bad news. This wasn't stealing candy, and it wasn't like when they were kids. Standing on a cliff 100 feet above the Hudson River, tip of the island, Freddie daring him to jump into the black water. Did Carney leap? He leaped, hollering all the way down. Now Freddie wanted him to jump into a slab of concrete. When Freddie called the office that afternoon, Carney told him it was no go and cussed him out for his poor judgment. The robbery was in all the news. Hotel Teresa heist. Black Harlem stunned by daring early morning robbery. Customers carried rumors and theories into the furniture store. They busted in with machine guns, and I heard they shot 5 people, and the Italian mafia did it to put us in our place. This last tidbit, put forth by the black nationalists on Lenox Avenue, hectoring from their soapboxes. No one was killed, according to the newspapers. Scared, sure. The robbery was early Wednesday morning. That evening, Carney locked the door at 6 o'clock and was almost done moping over his ledgers when his cousin knocked. Only Freddie knocked like that. He'd done it since they were kids, knocking on the frame of the bunk bed. "You still up? Hey, still up? I was thinking." Carney brought him into the office. Freddie plopped onto the argent couch and exhaled. He said, "I gotta say, I've been on my feet." "That was you with the Teresa? You okay?" Freddie wiggled his eyebrows. Carney cursed himself. He was supposed to be angry at his cousin, not worried about his health. Still, he was glad that Freddie was unscathed, looks of it. His cousin had the face he wore when he got laid or paid. Freddie sat up. "Rusty gone for the day? Tell me what happened." I am, but there's something I got to..." "Don't leave me hanging." "I'll get to it in a minute. It's just the guys are coming here. The guys I pulled the job with," he said. "You know how you said no? I didn't tell them that. They still think you're the man." Before Miami Joe and the crew arrived at Carney's furniture, there was time for monologues that ranged in tenor between condemnation and harangue. Carney expressed his rage toward and disappointment in his cousin and proceeded to a dissertation on Freddie's stupidity, illustrated with numerous examples, the boys having been born within a month of each other, and Freddie's boneheadedness and early-to-emerge character trait. Carney was also moved to share in emphatic terms why he now feared for himself and his family and his regret over the exposure of his sideline. There was also time for Freddie to tell the tale of the heist. Freddie had never been south of Atlantic City. Miami was an unimagined land, the customs of which he pieced together with details from Miami Joe. Miamians dressed well, for Miami Joe dressed well, his purple suits, solid or with pinstripes of different widths, masterfully tailored, complemented by his collection of short, fat kipper ties. Pocket squares jutted like weeds. In Miami, Freddie gathered, they turned out straight shooters. It was something in the water or a combination of the sun and the water. To hear Miami Joe expound on a subject, whether it was food, the treachery of females, or the simple eloquence of violence, was to see the world shorn of its civilized ruses. The only thing he dressed up nicely was himself. All else remained as naked and uncomplicated as God had created it. Miami Joe operated in New York City for 5 years after departing his hometown in the wake of an escapade. He found work as a collector for Reggie Green, maiming welshers, as well as shopkeepers who were miserly with protection money. But he tired of such easy game and returned to thieving. At Nightbirds, Freddie had recounted to Carney some of Miami Joe's more recent capers, a trailer full of vacuum cleaners, the payroll of a department store. The flashy, efficient scores were the ones Miami Joe chose to advertise, though he alluded to a host of others he kept private. Freddie and Miami Joe drank together at the Leopard Spots, the last to leave, the nights unfinished until the pair had been converted into rye-soaked cockroaches scurrying from sunlight and propriety. Freddie never failed to wake with a fear of what he'd revealed about himself. He hoped Miami Joe was too drunk to remember his stories, but Miami Joe did remember. It was more evidence for his unsentimental study of the human condition. The day Miami Joe brought him in, Freddie had recently quit running numbers for Pee Wee Gibson. "But you've never done a robbery before," Carney said. "He said I was going to be the wheelman. That's why I said yes." He shrugged. "What's so hard about that? 2 hands and a foot? The first convocation of the crew was held in a booth at Baby's Best, on the brink of happy hour. In the dressing room, the strippers covered their scars with powder. Blocks away, their faithful customers waited to punch out of straight jobs. The lights were going, though, spinning and whirring. Perhaps they never ever stopped, even when the place was closed, red and green and orange in restless, garish patrol over surfaces. It was Mars. Miami Joe had his arms spread on the red leather when Freddie walked in. Miami Joe, sipping Canadian Club and twisting his pinky rings as he mined the dark rock of his thoughts. Arthur was next to arrive. Embarrassed by the meeting place, like he'd never been in this kind of establishment before or spent his every hour there. Arthur was 48, hair corkscrewed with gray. He reminded Freddie of a schoolteacher. The man favored plaid, sweater vests, and dark slacks, wore bookworm glasses, and had a gentle way of pointing out flaws in aspects of the scheme. A policeman would spot that phony registration in a second. Is there another solution to this problem? He'd just finished his third stint in prison, thanks to a weakness for venal or otherwise incompetent comrades. Not this time. Arthur was the Jackie Robinson of safe-cracking, according to Miami Joe, having busted the color line when it came to safes and locks and alarms, generally regarded as the domain of white crooks. Pepper showed up last, and they got to business. "What about this man Pepper?" Carney asked. "Pepper," Freddie winced. "You'll see." Cocktails at the Hotel Teresa were a hot ticket, and Miami Joe often installed himself at the long, polished bar, talking with the rest of the neighborhood's criminal class. He took out one of the maids every once in a while, a slight, withdrawn girl named Betty. She lived at the Burbank, a once-dignified building on Riverside Drive that had been cut into single-room accommodations. A lot of new arrivals washed up there. Betty liked to stall before she let Miami Joe into her bed, which meant a lot of talking, and in due course he had enough information to plan the robbery. The idea of the job struck him the first time he laid eyes on the hotel. Where others saw sophistication and affirmation, Miami Joe recognized an opportunity for monetary gain and to take Black Harlem down a notch. These up-north inwards had an attitude about southern newcomers, he'd noticed, a pervasive condescension that made him boil. "What'd you say? Is that how y'all do it down there?" They thought their hotel was nice. He'd seen nicer. Not that he'd been able to provide an example if challenged on this point. Miami Joe was strictly hot sheet when it came to short-term accommodations. The hotel bar closed at 1 a.m., the lobby was dead by 4, and the morning shift started at 5, when the kitchen staff and the laundry workers punched in. Weekends were busier, and on Saturday nights the hotel manager ran gambling rooms for high rollers, which meant bodyguards and sore losers, too many surly men walking around with guns in their pockets. Tuesday night was Miami Joe's lucky night when it came to jobs. So Tuesday. He allotted 20 minutes for the takeover of the lobby and the raid of the vault. "Vault?" Freddie asked. It wasn't a real vault, Miami Joe told him. That was what they called the room containing the safe deposit boxes, behind the reception desk. Since they were smashing the boxes open, Arthur wouldn't be able to use his expertise, but he was dependable, a scarce quality. He was cool with it. He cleaned his glasses with a monogrammed handkerchief and said, "Sometimes you need a pick, sometimes a crowbar." 20 minutes, 4 men. Baby, the eponymous owner, brought them another round, refusing eye contact and payment. The crew debated the details as the happy hour trade grabbed stools at the bar and the music cranked up. Pepper kept his mouth shut, except to ask about the guns. He focused on his partner's faces, as if around a poker table, and not the wobbly formica of Baby's Best. Arthur thought 5 men was better, but Miami Joe preferred the 4-way split. At the safe cracker's gentle suggestion, they plucked Freddie out of the car and inducted him into the lobby action. It was only a few yards from the street to the hotel lobby, but infinitely closer to peril. Poor Freddie. Purple and blue lights sliding all over the place, this gun talk, it was unnerving. He didn't see a way to protest. Pepper glaring like that. The crew picked up on his hesitation, so when Miami Joe said that his usual fence had been pinched the week before, Freddie gave up Carney as an offering, although he did not phrase it to his cousin this way in his retelling. At 3:43 a.m. on the night of the job, Freddie parked the Chevy Style Line on 7th across from the Teresa on the uptown side of the street. As Miami Joe had promised, there were plenty of spots. The traffic at that hour was nothing. King Kong could come running down the street. There was no one to see it. Through the glass doors, Freddie could make out the night guard at the bell stand, fiddling with the long antenna of a transistor radio. He couldn't see the front desk, but the clerk was somewhere. The elevator operator sat lethargically on his stool or was on his feet directing the cab up or down, depending. Miami Joe said that one morning, 45 minutes had gone by without an elevator summons. It spooked Freddie, being in the night man's field of vision like that. He moved the Chevy closer to the corner where the guard couldn't see him. The knock at the window startled him. Two men got into the back seat, and Freddie panicked. Then he realized the disguises had thrown him off. "Settle down," Pepper said. Arthur wore a long, conked wig and a pencil mustache that made him look like a little Richard. Shaved 20 years off him, the time he'd spent in the joint refunded. Pepper was in a Hotel Teresa bellhop uniform, which Betty had stolen from the laundry 2 months ago. The night she grabbed it, she asked Miami Joe to put it on and say some dialogue before she permitted him to kiss her. It was all in the overhead. Pepper had had the uniform altered. He hadn't changed his facial appearance. He had gravel eyes that made you stare at your feet. The aluminum toolbox sat on his lap. 30 seconds before 4 a.m., Arthur got out of the car and crossed the median. His tie was loose, his jacket rumpled, his stride erratic. A musician turning in, or an out-of-town insurance salesman after a night in the big city. In short, a Hotel Teresa guest. The night man saw him and unlocked the front door. Chester Miller was in his late 50s, slim built except for his belly, which perched on his belt like an egg. A little sleepy. After 1 o'clock, the bar closed. Hotel policy was to allow only registered guests inside. "Perry, room 512, Arthur told the night man. They'd booked a room for 3 nights. The clerk wasn't at the front desk. Arthur hoped Miami Joe had that situation in hand. The night man flipped through the papers on his clipboard and pulled the brass door wide. Arthur had the gun in the man's ribcage when he turned to lock the door. He told him to take it easy. Freddie and Pepper were on the red carpet outside. The night man let them in and locked the door as directed. Freddie held 3 leather valises, a rubber howdy-doody mask covering his face. The crew had bought 2 of them at a Brooklyn Five and Dime 2 weeks earlier. Pepper carried the heavy toolbox. The door to the fire stairs was open, a crack. They were halfway to the registration desk when Miami Joe opened the door the rest of the way and entered the lobby. He'd been hiding in the stairwell for 3 hours. The howdy-doody mask had come on 5 minutes earlier, but as far as he was concerned, he'd been in disguise all night because he wasn't wearing a purple suit. There were no hard feelings about who got masks and who didn't. Some of the crew needed their faces revealed in order to do their jobs, and some didn't. The arrow above the elevator door indicated that the car was on the 12th floor, then the 11th. For most of the day, the hotel lobby hummed like Times Square. Guests and businessmen crisscrossing the white and black tiles, locals meeting for a meal and gossip, their number multiplied by the oversized mirrors that hung on the green and beige floral wallpaper. The doors to the phone booths by the elevator folded in and unfolded out, weird gills. At night, the swells congregated in their leather club chairs and on sofas and drank cocktails and smoked cigarettes as the door to the bar swung open and shut. Porters ferrying luggage on carts, teams of clerks at registration handling crises big and small, The shoeshine man insulting people in scuffed shoes and arguing for his services, it was an exuberant and motley chorus. All of that was done now, and the cast had shrunk to thieves and captives. The Nightman was pliable, as Miami Joe had promised. Miami Joe knew Chester from his nights at the hotel. He would do as he was told. This was one of the reasons Miami Joe had covered his face. The mask smelled like piney ointment and pushed his breath back at him, hot and rotten. Arthur nodded toward the bell on the desk, a signal for the Nightman to ding the clerk. When the clerk emerged from the offices, Miami Joe was upon him, one hand over his mouth and the other jabbing the nose of a .38 beneath the man's ears. One school held that the base of the skull was the best spot, the cool metal initiating a physical reaction of fear. But the Miami school, of which Joe was a disciple, liked below the ear. Only tongues went there, and metal made it eerie. There was an alarm with a wire to the police station, activated by a button beneath the desk where the guest book rested. Miami Joe stood between the clerk and the button. He motioned for the Nightman to come around so that Pepper could watch him and the clerk. "Elevator, I'm 4," Freddy said. Miami Joe grunted and went into the back. To the left was the switchboard, where an unexpected visitor waited. Some nights, the switchboard operator's friend kept her company. They were eating pea soup. The weeknight operator was named Anna Louise. She had worked at the Hotel Teresa for 30 years, since before it was desegregated, routing calls. Her chair swiveled. She liked the night work, joking with and mothering the succession of young desk clerks through the years, and she liked listening to the guest calls, the arguments and arrangements of room assignments, the lonely calls home through the cold, cold wires. The disembodied voices were a radio play, a peculiar one in which most of the characters appeared only once. Lulu visited Anna Louise at the switchboard every now and then. They had been lovers since high school and, around their building, referred to themselves as sisters. The lie had made sense when they first moved in, but it was silly now. No one really cares about other people when you get down to it. Their own struggles are too close up. The women screamed, then shut their mouths and put their hands up when Miami Joe aimed the gun. To the right was the manager's office. "Get the key," he said. Pepper brought the clerk and the Nightman into the office area. Miami Joe stood by the wall of iron bars that separated the room from the vault, far enough away to cover both the men and the women if they tried anything funny. He didn't think that was going to happen. They were rabbits, quivering and afraid. Miami Joe's voice was level and calm when he spoke to them, not to soothe, but because he thought it more sadistic. He felt the erotic rush he always got on jobs. It kicked in when the caper got going and dissipated when it was over, and then he didn't remember it until the next job. Never could get a hold of it when he wasn't thieving. It told him that his idea for the job and its practical execution were in harmony. When the elevator door opened, its two occupants saw a lean young man in a silly mask at the desk, looking at them. He nodded hello. Arthur swept around, his gun out. He waved the elevator operator and the passenger out of the cab and directed them behind the registration desk. By now, Pepper had taken the key to the manager's office from the clerk and was conducting the four other captives into the room. Rob Reynolds, the manager of the hotel, had arranged a nice refuge for himself. There were no windows, so he'd created some. Tasseled curtains, identical to those in the finest suites upstairs. Framed, painted Venetian scenes. After the afternoon rush, he liked to imagine that was him under the hat, steering a gondola down salty boulevards in silence. An overstuffed sofa matched the ones in the lobby, though this one had endured less wear and tear. One man's naps and quickie Fs with past-due long-term residents couldn't compete with the weight of hordes. Autographed photos of famous guests and residents covered the walls. Duke Ellington, Richard White, Ella Fitzgerald in a ball gown, long white gloves up to her elbows. Rob Reynolds had provided exemplary service over the years, the standard amenities, and the secret ones. Late-night smack deliveries, last-minute terminations via the Jamaican abortionist who kept two rooms on the seventh floor. It was no surprise in some quarters when the gentleman turned out to be not a doctor at all. In many of the pictures, Rob Reynolds was shaking hands with the Hotel Teresa's celebrity visitors and grinning. Miami Joe checked the desk drawer for a gun. This had just occurred to him. He didn't find one. He asked the clerk where they kept the cards that tracked the safe deposit boxes. The young clerk had gone by Ricky his whole life, but these days wanted folks to call him Richard. It was a tough haul. His family and those he grew up with were a lost cause. New acquaintances switched to the nickname as if they'd received instructions by telegram. The hotel was the only place where people called him Richard. No defections so far. This was his first real job, and each time he walked through those front doors, he stepped into himself, into the man he wanted to be. Clerk, assistant manager, top dog, with this office to call his own. He pointed to a metal box that sat on the desk between the phone and Rob Reynolds' nameplate. Miami Joe directed the captives to the rug beside the couch. Lie there with your eyes closed. Freddie covered them from the doorway. Freddie wasn't a gunman, but Miami Joe figured he was jumpy enough that he'd get off a shot if anyone moved. It didn't matter if he missed, so long as it bought the rest of the crew time to put down an insurrection. The team hit their marks. They wore thin calfskin gloves. Pepper, in his bellhop uniform, took up his station at the front desk. Arthur had unlocked the door to the vault, and now he and Miami Joe stood before the bank of safe deposit boxes. The brass-colored boxes were a foot tall and 8 inches wide, and deep enough for jewelry, bundled cash, cheap furs, and unsent suicide notes. Arthur said, "This is all Drummond. You said they were Aikens." "Well, that's what I heard." Aikens took three or four good whacks before there was enough purchase for a crowbar. Maybe that was why they'd replaced them with Drummonds, Arthur thought, which required 6 to 8 whacks. The take had been cut in half if they stuck to the timetable. Miami Joe said 78. Arthur got to work with the sledgehammer. The index cards recorded the box number, the name of the guest, the contents, and the day of the deposit. The manager had sissy handwriting that was easy to read. Arthur got into box 78 after 6 blows and started on the next while Miami Joe cleaned it out. The contents matched what was on the card. 2 diamond necklaces, 3 rings, and some documents. He put the jewelry into a black valise and searched the cards for the next box to hit. If the banging rattled Pepper, he didn't show it. He'd been at the desk for 1 minute when he concluded that working registration was a lousy job. Most straight jobs were, in Pepper's estimation, which is why he hadn't held one in many years. But this gig was spectacularly bad. What with all the people, the constant yipping and complaints, "My room's too cold, my room's too hot, can you send up a newspaper, the street noise is too loud." Fork over $30 and suddenly they're royalty, ruling over a 12-by-14-foot kingdom. Shared bathroom down the hall unless they pay extra. His father had worked in a hotel kitchen, cooking chops and steaks. He came home stinking every night, in addition to his general sense of worthlessness, but Pepper would take that work over desk duty any day. Talking to these effin' mopes. Bang, bang, bang! Arthur attacked the safe deposit boxes. Pepper got the first call about the noise 5 minutes later. The switchboard buzzed, and Freddie told the operator to get up and answer it. Anna Louise put rooms 313 call through. "Front desk," Pepper said. It was the voice he used when he was telling a joke and making fun of white people. He apologized for the banging and said they were fixing the elevator, but they'd be done soon. "If you come to the front desk in the morning," he added, "we'll give you a voucher for 10% off breakfast." The mezzanine floor was offices and a club room. Shut now. And the orchid room occupied most of the third, or else they'd be getting a lot more calls. Mr. Goodall, in room 313, had a voice like a chipmunk, whiny and entitled. "Fry chicken all day long in that kitchen heat over this goddamn job?" Tell her to stay at the switchboard in case there's more, Miami Joe said. Freddie stood in the doorway of the manager's office. He'd sweat through his shirt and into his black suit. The eye holes in the mask made him think something outside his range of vision was about to clobber him. The men and the women on the floor didn't move. He said, "Don't move, anyway." His mother did that all the time. Tell him not to do something right before he was about to do it, like he was made of glass and she could see inside. But so many things lived in his head that she never suspected. He hadn't had that little boy feeling in a long time, till tonight. He'd jumped off the Hudson Cliffs, but instead of hitting the river, he kept falling. Freddie wasn't able to pull the trigger, so he hoped the captives would do what they were supposed to do. At her station, Ana Luise covered her face with her hands. Bang! 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 The rug was freshly vacuumed, which suited the captives who had their faces in it. The elevator passenger, the man from the 12th floor, was named Lancelot St. John. He lived two blocks away, and his occupation was sitting at the hotel bar until he lit upon a suitable lady from out of town. If his quarry picked up on his euphemisms, Lancelot straightened out the money before he undressed her. If not, afterward, he mentioned a present he wanted to buy for his mother, but he was a little short this week. In the service industry, you shift your approach depending on the customer. Tonight's lady had flown in from Chicago to speak to a real estate lawyer about a brownstone she'd recently inherited. Her mother had passed. Perhaps that explained the tears. He had walked into robberies before. He'd be in bed soon enough. It was almost time for the Teresa to wake to the day, and the criminals had to wrap it up. The elevator operator had done time for stealing a car, and later that day, when questioned by detectives, he said he didn't see a darn thing. Arthur smiled. It was good to be out. It was good to be stealing again, even if a quick glance told him that half the jewelry was paste. Half of it was real, fine-quality stones. He measured his prison time in terms not of lost years, but of scores missed. The city and all its busy people and the sweet things they held dear in safes and vaults and his delicate talent for seducing these items away. He'd bought farmland in Pennsylvania through a white lawyer, and it was waiting for him, this green wonder. Arthur had put the pictures the lawyer sent him in his cell. His cellmate asked him what the hell it was, and he told him it was where he'd grown up. Arthur had grown up in a Bronx tenement, fighting off rats every night, but when he finally retired to the nice clapboard house, he'd run through the grass like he was a kid again. Every hammer blow like he was busting through city concrete to the living earth below. Bang! 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 They got two more calls about the banging. It was loud, rebounding on the vault walls, vibrating in the very bones of the building. The excuse about the broken elevator came about after they decided to keep the operator on ice in the office. How many people would call for the elevator between 4 and 4:20 a.m.? Maybe none. Maybe plenty. How many would take the stairs down and be ushered by Pepper in his gentle way into the office with the other captives? Just one, it turned out. At 4:17, a certain Fernando Gabriel Ruiz, a Venezuelan national and a distributor of handcrafted crockery, who would never visit this city again after what happened last time and now this. And how many guests knocked on the front door to be let into the rooms? Also one. Pepper unlocked the door and marched Mr. Leonard Gates of Gary, Indiana, currently staying in room 807 with its lumpy bed and the hex from the guy who'd had a heart attack there, into the back with the rest of them. Plenty of room in the manager's office. Stack them like firewood, or standing room only, if need be. Given that only two souls had intruded on their scheme, Miami Joe said, "Keep going," when Arthur told him 20 minutes was up. He wanted to push their luck. Arthur kept swinging. Freddie became aware of his bladder. Pepper said, "It's time." It wasn't his visceral distaste for the front desk and the interaction it represented. "You tell Pepper it's 20 minutes, it's 20 minutes. Arthur kept swinging. Pepper could take care of himself if it went south. He didn't know about the rest of the crew, and he didn't care. When the fourth complaint about the noise came in, he told room 405 that the elevator was being fixed, and if they bothered him again, he'd come up there and beat them with his belt. Pepper permitted them to empty four more deposit boxes. He said, "It's time." It was not his white boy voice. They'd filled two valises. Miami Joe said, "Now." Arthur packed the toolbox, and Miami Joe put the index cards inside two to mess up the next day's sorting out. He almost left the empty valise, then remembered that the cops might trace it. Pepper cut the wire to the police station, and Freddie yanked the office phone out of the wall. They weren't neutralizing the switchboard, so this didn't change their chances materially, but it was a show of enthusiasm that Freddie hoped would serve his cause in the postmortem. In Baby's Best, Miami Joe might mention it and affirm him. Those melancholy lights roving over him, red and purple. Miami Joe recited the names of the staff, Anna Louise, the clerk, the nightman, the elevator operator, and shared their addresses. If anyone so much as twitched before 5 minutes was up, he said, it was their job to stop that person because he knew where they lived. The bandits were a mile away when Lancelot St. John sat up and asked, "Now?" The thieves were overdue at Carney's store. Carney had a notion to turn out the lights and hide in the basement. "And what do you expect me to do when they get here?" Carney said. "Check out the stash? Pay them for it?" Freddie bent over to tie his shoes. "You always want in the end," he said. "That's why I gave them your name." Carney stopped himself from saying what he'd been thinking the whole time. "You must have been scared." They weren't hoods. Freddie was a petty thief. Carney moved previously owned items onto their next destination. They didn't hold people hostage and keep lists of places to buy untraceable howdy duty masks. But, as his cousin talked, Carney hadn't recognized himself and the innocents who'd been swept up in it, the switchboard operator and the rest. He'd thought about how he would have pulled it off. Most mornings, after all, he grabbed breakfast at the chock full of nuts on the first floor of the Teresa. One day, after he and Freddie had talked, he'd put down his Collins Hathaway catalog, new modular living for fall, and found himself casing the joint. Through that door, you passed into the cocktail bar and then into the lobby. There were three ways into the lobby, the bar, the street, and the clothing boutique, plus the elevators and fire stairs. Three men at the big front desk, guests coming and going all hours. Carney stopped himself. He sipped his coffee. Sometimes he slipped and his mind went that away. He'd never robbed anything in his life, yet there he was. He was only slightly bent when it came to being crooked, in practice and in ambition. The odd piece of jewelry, the electronic appliances that Freddie and then a few other local characters brought by the store, he could justify. Nothing major. Nothing that attracted undue attention to his store. The front he put out to the world. If he got a thrill out of transforming these ill-gotten goods into legit merchandise, a zap charge in his blood like he'd plugged into a socket, he was in control of it, and not the other way around. Dizzying and powerful as it was, everyone had secret corners and alleys that no one else saw. What mattered were your major streets and boulevards, the stuff that showed up on other people's maps of you. The thing inside him that gave a yell or a tug or a shout now and again was not the sickness Freddie ministered to, more and more. Fact was, he didn't have the contacts to handle the take from the Hotel Teresa. Neither did his man Buxbaum down on Canal. Have a coronary if Carney walked in with that kind of weight. The crew wouldn't be happy when they discovered that he was not the man Freddie had described. The front door buzzed. The thieves had arrived. "I got it," Freddie said. He rose. Carney sat up, straightened his tie. He couldn't blame his cousin. He always said yes, didn't he? He'd been in on the Teresa job since Nightbirds, even if he didn't want to admit it. When they used to stand on the cliff over the Hudson, Carney had always eventually jumped. The thieves buzzed again. They took their places. The wheelman, the muscle, the safecracker. But it wasn't a heist until the fence stepped in. He got to work. And now, from the books section of the July 26, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, are Americans more trusting than they seem? Political scientists say that our confidence in our institutions and in one another is running perilously low. Economists see a different story. By Idris Kalun. The dominant tenor of contemporary American politics would seem to be mistrust. Trumpism is its purest expression, impermeable even to the humiliation of an electoral rebuke. The majority of Trump supporters still doubt the legitimacy of Joe Biden's victory. Diehards in Arizona are, more than a half a year after the election, searching fruitlessly for bamboo fibers on ballots to prove that they were flown in from Asia. Conservative news outlets remain committed to the lucrative business of constructing hermetically sealed echo chambers. Although the forces of animosity, resentment, and paranoia are asymmetrically distributed, they are hardly the exclusive province of one political faction. Walk the streets of Portland, Oregon, and you will see evidence of another legitimacy crisis. Not long ago, outside the Red House, the site of a months-long resistance by activists against an attempted eviction, one could find a plywood sign with a simple edict printed in blue and black spray paint: Kill Cops. Where theories of institutional and systemic oppression circulate, it should not be surprising to find contempt for institutions and systems. Democracy's most basic currency is trust, and to judge by the usual indicators, we seem to be running out of it. Back in 1964, more than three-quarters of Americans said that they trusted the federal government. Today, according to the Pew Research Center, only a quarter of Americans do. In the 1970s, Gallup found that around 70% of people trusted the media. Today, about 40% do. Even worse, trust in the media has become polarized along party lines. While 3 in 4 Democrats say that they trust the media, only 1 in 10 Republicans would say so. As recently as 2000, the share among Republicans was 1 in 2. Americans also report having more animosity toward one another than they used to. Surveys by the political scientists Liliana Mason and Nathan Calmo found that half of registered voters think that the opposing party is not just bad, but downright evil. A quarter concur that if that party's members are going to behave badly, they should be treated like animals. The Harvard political scientist Robert D. Putnam, who did so much to focus attention on civic associations and social trust in his book Bowling Alone, from 2000, offers an alarming update in his latest book, The Upswing, written with Shailen Romney Garrett. According to Putnam's metrics, our social capital, the associational richness of American life, has been dropping steadily. Quote, we have been experiencing declining economic equality, the deterioration of compromise in the public square, a fraying social fabric, and a descent into cultural narcissism, end quote. Four horsemen stalking America. The commentator David Brooks sees an epidemic of mistrust as an existential threat. Quote, levels of trust in this country, in our institutions, in our politics, and in one another are in precipitous decline. And when social trust collapses, nations fail. If trust appears to be languishing in the political realm, though, it appears to be thriving in another important institution of modern society, capitalism. The modern sharing economy is premised on leaps of faith in perfect strangers. We rely on crowdsourced restaurant reviews on Yelp, climb into a stranger's car through Uber, stay at someone else's house via Airbnb, and look for love on Bumble, Hinge, and sundry other dating apps. A financial trust index set up by the economist Paolo Sapienza and Luigi Zingales during the Great Recession has shown consistent growth in the past decade. The supply of money has more than doubled since the recession, and yet we've seen few paroxysms of gold buggery or other disorders of mistrust. Interest rates, which rise when investors lose trust in repayment, remain close to zero. So what's really going on? People don't see the phenomenal trust embedded in the modern economy for the same reason that David Foster Wallace's fishes could not fathom water. Everything is predicated on its existence. Adam Smith concluded that trust was a fundamental feature of humanity. Quote, "Nobody ever saw a dog make a fair and deliberate exchange of one bone for another with another dog," he wrote in The Wealth of Nations. Kenneth Arrow, just before winning a Nobel Prize, extolled trust as a, quote, "lubricant," end quote, of a social system and extremely efficient mechanism for easing transactions and promoting prosperity. Unfortunately, this is not a commodity which can be bought very easily, Arrow warned. If you have to buy it, you already have some doubts about what you bought. Even in the aftermath of the Great Recession, Joseph Stiglitz, the tireless critic of inequality, who has a Nobel Prize of his own, observed, "It is trust, more than money, that makes the world go round." Ask yourself the simple question, what is money? And you'll have to come to grips with the fact that at least since the dollar came off the gold standard in 1971, our currency has been nothing more than trust itself, its value sustained by the power of communal belief. The humble, crumpled dollar bill in your pocket evokes the concept, "In God we trust." Less grandly, the thing you're trusting is the full faith and credit of the United States government. Fractional reserve banking, which allows a bank to lend far more in credit than it has in deposits, has driven capitalism for centuries. Many economic crises, when examined closely, turn out to be crises of confidence. This is obviously true of a bank run, when depositors lose faith in the fractional reserve system. But it's also true of hyperinflationary spirals, when worries about a country's handling of monetary policy yank down the value of its currency. There is a reason that the core language of commerce, of bonds and credits, is all about belief. But modern economists have largely ceded the study of trust to other disciplines, like anthropology, sociology, political science, and psychology. Now, in Why Trust Matters, published by Columbia, Benjamin Ho, a professor of economics at Vassar College, aims to resuscitate it within his field. He traces his zeal for modeling human behavior to a childhood fascination with Harry Seldon, the mathematician protagonist of Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, who tries to save civilization using psychohistory, a set of equations allowing far-sighted sociological forecasting. Ho writes, "One could tell the story of human civilization as a story of how we learned to trust one another. We learned first to share the spoils of a group hunt, instead of hunting and eating, or not eating alone." He cites the British evolutionary psychologist Robin Dunbar, who noticed that natural community size for primates seemed directly related to brain size. The greater the relative size of the neocortex, the larger the tribe. For large-brained Homo sapiens, the predicted maximal group size, also called Dunbar's number, was 150. The number, Dunbar says, recurs in the estimated average sizes of the Bronze Age communities that built stone circles, of Anglo-Saxon villages listed in the Domesday Book, and of contemporary Facebook communities. The concept has its critics, but the basic idea is that there are probably capacity constraints on the number of personal connections we can make with our fellow humans seems hard to dispute. How then did societies evolve to the point where people felt some commonality with thousands, millions, and eventually billions of other people? Our essential innovation was a simple one, forming groups, in-groups and out-groups, that could ramp up far beyond our small bands. As Ho writes, tribes became villages, which became towns, city-states, nations. Through elastic social identities, we found ways of sustaining tribal affiliations at large scale. You could trade with someone from your tribe even if you didn't know them. although our greater trust and loyalty toward the in-group meant greater distrust and hostility toward the out-group. Religion proved to be an especially powerful social glue, providing common purpose, mutual protection, and a modicum of alms distribution, often reinforced by the idea of retributive deities and their earthly emissaries. Secular institutions, meanwhile, became more complex. Even in the absence of money, gift-giving cultures like the Kula ring that so fascinated the anthropologists Bronislaw Malinowski and Marcel Mauss developed out of the need for reciprocal exchange. And both the desire to belong and the fear of being kicked out made trust easier to guarantee. In other societies, trust was broadened from the directly interpersonal to ever more abstract institutions. The anti-counterfeiting technology of the Roman mints, the self-regulation of the medieval guilds, newfangled paper money, the solvency of governments, the fair enforcement of contracts by courts, and more recently, the proper design of an algorithm. Needless to say, the world is only just emerging from a vast experiment in collective trust. The triumph of the scientific community in the rapid development of COVID-19 vaccines, starting with the Chinese researchers who shared the sequence of the novel coronavirus, represents perhaps the most successful transnational collaboration in human history. Going on lockdown during the pandemic was, in large part, an altruistic task, and it was engaged in by the majority of the population. The financial fallout from the pandemic protocols in the U.S. was quite effectively cushioned, to such an extent that a main economic fear these days is that the economy will grow too quickly. What's more, in America, it appears that most states will handle future risk, not formally through vaccine passports, but through the honor system. And yet the management of the crisis has been at every step shadowed by conspiracy, doubt, and hesitancy, all of which have tended to swallow up the successes of scientific and fiscal policy. Last spring, it might have been hoped that America's acrimonious tribalism would be suspended in the face of a national calamity. That the pandemic was so easily subsumed into the culture wars shows that the resolution won't be easy. Don't trust anyone who tells you otherwise. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and will be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.